The next speaker that we have, last speaker on our agenda, Dr. Luis Herrera Estrella, is going to talk to us about cotton genetics and weed control, and I'll just get out of his way and let him take over here.
Hi, good afternoon. I thank the organizers for inviting me to present some of our work to you, and to you for staying so late to wait for the last talk. I'm a scientist, so I'm not going to talk about laws or about programs. I'm going to talk about a few projects we are doing to try to help sustainability in agriculture. So I was recruited by Texas Tech University about 13 months ago to direct a new institute, the Institute of Genomics for Crop Abiotic Stress Tolerance. And the main goal of the institute is to develop technology to optimize the use of natural resources and decrease the use of agrochemicals to diminish the impact of agriculture on the environment and create a significant social and economic benefit for the farmer. That's the main objective of the institute, and we want to do high-quality research, which is completely innovative, to try to bring new solutions to old problems. So this is some of the faculty members that we are recruiting, people specialists in different areas. We are bringing people from all around the world to create a team that can understand how plants function and how can we apply this knowledge to create new varieties that are more suitable for the adverse environmental conditions that we will face in the future. Although there is not a consensus on the effect of climate change, and in fact some people doesn't believe in climate change, we have seen already that rains are not as expected before, they are more erratic, that temperatures are also changing quite a bit, and that affects not only the plant itself, but also the pests and diseases that affect the plants. Because depending upon the humidity and temperature, plants are affected by different problems. So we are going to concentrate in the institute to work on several problems which we have identified as important and probably you know better than us. So drought is problem number one. Water is becoming limited everywhere. We just heard several specialists talking about water availability, and that's a very serious problem. And if we want to have sustainability, we have to optimize the use of water in agriculture. Low soil fertility, we need to also work to make plants that adding less fertilizer, we can get the same or more higher yields. And also weeds, which is also an important problem for not only cotton, but any crop that we want to produce. So I'm going to talk a little bit about water, about drought. When we have water, we have life. When we don't have water, it's a synonymous of death. So people who is familiar with the desert and with drought have seen these problems. So I'm not going to talk about the water use concerns because it's been already mentioned, all the problems that water is going to bring if we don't optimize the resources, the surface water and underground water that we are using in the state of Texas. So what I want to tell you is about how can we study biology to try to tackle these problems. And we are interested in a biological phenomenon which is actually quite interesting. And that's why some organisms can tolerate desiccation. So this little crustacean is called Artemia salina. It lives in ponds, in salty ponds, that dry out. So these little animals lay eggs, and the eggs can be viable for many years. 10 years, and the egg is still viable. This other little animal, which is called a water bear, or tardigrades, is an extraordinary little animal. It's a few millimeters in size. It has 8 legs, and it can withstand desiccation. You can dry the little animal, and it can withstand desiccation for 50 years. You put it back in water, and the animal comes back to life. This little animal was taken to the space shuttle, take outside the space shuttle without any protection. You know, there are many cosmic rays. They brought it back, put it in water, and the animal is still alive. So it's very resilient to all this damage. So if we can understand the biology of these processes, we probably can develop technologies that can be very useful. But the most spectacular desiccation tolerance phenomenon is in plants. Can you run the video? This is a family of plants that are called resurrection plants. So these plants can be completely dry out. If you click on the picture, you will see an arrow. It's playing there, but not here. Okay. Well, maybe it will not show. But this plant can be completely dried out. And it can be dried out for months or years. And when rain comes, the plant starts to come back alive after being completely dried out for months or years. It comes back to life. So it's a very spectacular thing to watch, but unfortunately we cannot see the movie. Can you move to the next one? Oh, I can move it myself. Oops, it's not moving. There are different families. One is Craterostigma, and the other one is Selaginella. And there are these plants. Selaginella is native to the desert of Chihuahua, so you find some in Texas. So it's the northern part of Mexico and the southern part of the United States where these plants are naturally occurring. So the most fantastic desiccation tolerance process takes place in plant seeds. So these seeds are from an acacia plant that were taken from a herbarium in Iran by Swedish scientists. The seeds were 151 years old in their herbarium. The Swedish scientists took to the lab, and the seeds are still viable. You know, in the seed, there is a little embryo of a plant. And when you water the plant, this little embryo gives rise to a plant. So this little embryo had to survive for 151 years, completely desiccated. How comes that the cells, the embryo, remains alive during all this period? These are lotus seeds that were excavated from a Chinese tomb. They are 1,300 years old. So you take the seeds, you put them in water, still alive. The record so far is from date seeds excavated from an Egyptian tomb. These date seeds are 2,000 years old. You put it on soil, and the seed is still viable. So how comes that these cells in the embryo, inside the seed, can survive? So that means that during the formation of the seed, a mechanism is activated that protects these cells against temperature, desiccation, all the problems that the seed can have. If we understand what is the mechanism that protects these cells, we might be able to protect plants in the field against drought. So one of the things we want to do is to understand how this process is coordinated. You know, a plant has 30,000, 40,000 genes, functions. The genome of a plant that contains all the genetic instructions to build up the plant and give all the specific characteristics of the plant, the instructions to make cotton fibers, is in the genes of the cotton plant. In the seed, there are probably 15,000 genes that are operating at the same time. So these genes interact with each other and form networks in the same way that communication networks act. If you have many antennas of cellular phones in each town, in each place, they all have to interact to communicate each other. And there are central stations that coordinate the activity of many antennas. And these centrals communicate to each other. So these central stations are the ones that control the communications all around the world. So what we want to find is what are these central stations that coordinate the genes of a plant to make the seed desiccation tolerant. So we have done studies, and I'm not going to get into the technical details as to how we do this, but we can build a network and find what is the specific network that is activated during the process of seed formation. During the process of seed formation, you first have to the process of the embryo formation. So you get the little plant form after pollinization, and inside the seed, when it reaches a certain size, the seed starts to desiccate, and at that point in time, it activates the mechanisms of protection. So this mechanism of protection, you can study what is the network that controls this mechanism. There are many, many functions here, many genes, but these are the central stations. These central stations control the communication of all these genes. So if we can identify who are these central stations, and we can activate them now, not in the seed, but in the tissues we want, for instance, in the leaves or in the flowers, we might be able to make the leaves or the flowers more resilient to this, to water loss. So what we have done is identify some of these central stations and activate them in the leaves of a plant and see what happens. If they act as a network, one alone will not be sufficient to have an effect. You will need 1, 2, 3, maybe 4 to really activate enough functions to make the plant more resilient to drought. So we have done that. We have activated these central stations in the leaves of a plant. How do we assay if they have any effect on the plant? So what we do is we germinate seeds, we water them for a certain amount of time, let's say 10 days. Once the plants are developed, we stop watering for different amount of times. Could be 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and so on. Once they are completely dried out, we rewater the plant. Once we rewater the plant, we evaluate how many of these plants survive the drought period. Okay? And that's what we have found. This is just a table in which we plot the survival. If you activate only one gene, you have a low level of survival. If you activate another one, it's the same. But if you activate three of these central stations, you get a very high level of tolerance. And that's how it looks. So this is when the plants have been drought. These are the ones that have activated the genes, the central stations I was talking about, and this is the original plant. So we let them dry out completely, and then we water them again. The original plant just dies. It's not capable of surviving for 2 weeks without any water in a small pot. These ones in which we have tweaked these central stations to be active in the leaves, they survive the treatment. And depending upon which central stations we activate, we have different mechanisms of tolerating drought. So we hope that in the near future we can optimize this system for different crops so that we can allow them to survive either longer periods of drought, or that we can make them be capable of producing the same with less water because their cells are protected. So the other topic we are working is on weed control. Weeds became more of a problem recently because they have become resistant to herbicides. So usually, when you grow something, there are weeds that are very aggressive and they grow faster than your crop. And as you know, they will eventually kill your plant. They compete with the crop for all the resources. They compete for the water, they compete for the nutrients in the soil, and they compete for the light. If they take all these resources, your crop is going to be dead. That's why you apply a fertilizer. If you apply a fertilizer which doesn't kill your crop, but kills the weeds, then you can protect your crop. That's the technology that has been used in cotton for the past 15 years, 20 years. But now the weeds have become herbicide resistant. This is the increase of herbicide resistant biotaps in the past 30 years. So the more we use herbicides, and we use the same herbicide all the time, weeds become resistant. It's like antibiotics. If we don't use properly antibiotics, the microbes that harm our body become resistant to the antibiotic, and then we cannot kill them. So that's what has happened with these herbicide-resistant cotton, maize, soybean, and so on. This is a map showing the dynamic dispersion of herbicide resistant in wheat. So it started in 2006, and in less than 10 years, it was spread all over the United States. It spread extremely fast. So this is now a big problem, particularly for cotton producers, because now glyphosate is not very effective, and the new strategies, including dicamba to control weeds, have some problems that make difficult the general use of the new technology. And this is how it happened. Originally, this is Amaranthus palmieri, one of the most aggressive weeds that have become resistant. So before 2007, the plant was very susceptible to glyphosate. So with 200 grams per acre you could control this weed. In 2007, it became resistant. Now, instead of 200 grams, you needed 1,700 grams per acre. And the plant was still not killed. 2010, now it's not 200 grams. Sorry, I still talk about grams and kilograms. I'm still not used to pounds and ounces and all these things. But you can see the numbers. Here, now it's double, and it doesn't kill it. Now it's 5 kilograms, and it's still resistant. And this from 2007 to 2012. So the weed adapted very fast to the herbicide. This was completely unexpected. The technology developed, the Roundup Ready technology developed by Monsanto, it was fantastic. It was extremely effective. But nobody expected that weeds would become resistant so rapidly. So why don't we take a completely different approach? When we apply fertilizer to a field to grow our crop, we are not only feeding our crop, we are also feeding weeds. The more we feed, the more herbicide we need to apply to kill them. So there are essential minerals that you need for the plant to grow. In fact, this is a microalgae. Any organism needs phosphorus to grow. And most organisms can only use phosphate as a phosphorus source. So it's the only way you can fertilize your crops, applying phosphate fertilizer. So the idea is, if you fertilize with phosphate, you promote the growth of everybody, the weeds, your crops, and so on. If you don't apply a herbicide, weeds are going to compete with your cotton, and production is going to be reduced or even completely lost. What happens if we feed our plant with a chemical form of phosphorus that weeds cannot use as food, but your crop can use it as food? Can we make, rather than killing the weed, provide a fertilization system that is selective for your crop so that you can promote the growth of your crop, and now the one that is going to eliminate the others is your crop and not weeds? So we studied a lot of the chemistry of phosphorus, and we bump into a compound which is not phosphate. Phosphate is PO4, the chemical formula. Phosphate are PO3. So this is a chemical form of phosphorus which has many advantages as a fertilizer. It doesn't get fixed into the soil in the same way as phosphate, and so on. The problem is that plants cannot use phosphate as a nutrient. They cannot use this mineral form of phosphorus to feed themselves. But what if we modify the plants to use it? So we did the modification. So this is a tobacco plant without fertilization, fertilized with phosphate, and fertilized with phosphate. So in fact, this grows even worse than without any fertilization, because phosphate inhibits the growth of plants. It doesn't kill them, but it reduces the growth of the plant. When we modify the plant, now our plant can grow in phosphate and phosphate. So we can make this plant use a chemical form of phosphorus, which normally plants cannot use. So can we use phosphate to selectively fertilize crops and promote the growth of the crop, inhibit the growth of the weeds, and eliminate or reduce the need of using herbicides? These are experiments in the greenhouse. You have cotton here with weeds, natural weeds. This is a natural soil that we use from San Angelo here in Texas. You hardly see your cotton here because weeds grow faster. What happens if instead of fertilizing with phosphate, you fertilize with phosphite? This here is your cotton, and here are your weeds. Why do this happen? Because cotton can use phosphate as a nutrient to grow, and the weeds cannot, and their growth is inhibited. So that's how it works. This we did in collaboration, maybe I shouldn't say being part of Texas Tech, we did it in collaboration with Texas A&M and funded by Cotton Inc. Somehow, for reasons I still don't understand, there is a dispute between Texas Tech and Texas A&M, which I don't know if it's related to the football or what is the problem, but they tell me I shouldn't talk too much about Texas A&M. We published this work in one of the major journals, in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in the U.S., and this is how it looks under field conditions. This is a natural field infested with weeds. If you apply phosphate, you delay the emergence of weeds because they don't like phosphate. They are not dead. You can see that they are starting to emerge, but much later than if you either don't fertilize or fertilize with phosphate. And this is how it looks in cotton in the field. So we apply phosphate here. This is the modified plants. They are growing happily. These are the controls, the not modified cotton, and there are no weeds on the soil. So the phosphate controls the growth of the weeds and the non-transgenic cotton. So this suggests that this technology could be used. We still are far from having it ready for the farmer because we need to formulate the best in the best way so that it's the most effective, that we reduce the amount of phosphorus we have to apply, and that we reduce the contamination with phosphorus, the groundwater, which is also a huge problem. We use an excess of fertilizer, and that brings about a lot of ecological problems. So we need to optimize all the system to use it. So I'm going to stop here. I had a few things more, but I want to stop here, and I'll be happy to answer any question that you have. I know you are tired, so I'll just reduce a little bit my talk. Thank you very much.